Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. It's not just for contracting officers. If you're anywhere in the government acquisition world, this podcast is for you. Today, we're talking subcontracting plans, and this episode is brought to you by Skyway Acquisition. You can learn more at skywayacq.com. Let's get this podcast started. One of the basic principles underlying government contracting is to provide opportunities for small businesses.
We have a whole lot of episodes about small business set-aside, small business goals, like the overall process of small business. But there's also subcontracting. There's subcontracting goals. There are these things called subcontracting plans. And that's the basis of how the subcontracting will work throughout an actual contract.
Before we get into that, let's stop and say thanks.
Thanks this week goes to Brian Bott. Brian is a construction manager at FEMA, at the Federal Emergency Management Administration. Brian's in the Los Angeles, California area. I want to thank Brian for sharing our episode about the four categories of government acquisition on LinkedIn. And people specifically like and share our content, particularly share it on LinkedIn, more people can find it.
Thanks, Brian. We're talking about small business subcontracting plans today. And a subcontracting plan is a formal plan approved by the government, by the contracting officer, who, of course, is the approver for most things government acquisition. A subcontracting plan describes how the prime contractor intends to award to subcontractors, particularly to small businesses. And we'll jump right into the FAR. This is FAR 19.7, called the Small Business Subcontracting Program.
The small business subcontracting is a big enough deal that this is the whole section in the FAR.
FAR 19.702 tells you that it is a statutory requirement. That's how it ended up in the FAR. It says any contractor receiving a contract with a value greater than the simplified acquisition threshold, which is currently $250,000, must agree in the contract that small businesses, veteran-owned small businesses, service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses, hub-zone small businesses, and small disadvantaged businesses, oh, and there's one more, and women-owned small business concerns. So all of the types of small businesses that the FAR calls out, if you get a contract greater than $250,000, you have to agree that all these types of small businesses will have the maximum practicable opportunity to participate in contract performance consistent with its efficient performance.
Well, there are two variables in that. One, maximum practical opportunity, that's a judgment call, and within the efficient performance of the contract. That's another phrase you could drive a truck through. But the point of this is the expectation is if you have a contract worth over $250,000, you're going to find a way to subcontract some of that and have a plan to do so to all these types of small businesses.
This is one of those situations where the fact of this program drives some inefficiencies into the system. This is one of those things where we as a country, as a government, as a people have decided it is important for us to support small businesses. So we're going to put into our government contracting where so much money flows, we're going to put in requirements that say you have to provide subcontract opportunities to small businesses. And that recognizes the fact that that's going to be slightly less efficient, right? Rather than awarding to whatever business is going to give you the lowest price or have the greatest chance to perform with the lowest risk, whatever criteria you would normally use when selecting a subcontractor, now you have to add in, oh, are they a small business and what kind of small business are they? So it's driving in some inefficiencies, but for a purpose. And that's why we're talking about it today, because contractors might not do this, probably wouldn't do this if it were not in the FAR. All right, now that that speech is over, let me get back to the FAR 19702A. 19702A, one little I, tells us when a subcontracting plan is required. It says in negotiated acquisitions, if your contract is expected to exceed $750,000 or $1.5 million for construction, and it has subcontracting possibilities, the winner has to submit an acceptable subcontracting plan to the contracting officer. So if you're selected, if you won the competition, you submit a subcontracting plan. If it's not acceptable to the contracting officer and you can't negotiate an acceptable plan, The FAR says you can be declared ineligible for award. Bottom line, you have to submit a plan that the contracting officer accepts, or they can move on to somebody else that does have a better plan to support small businesses.
This is why oftentimes I would require, and most agencies seem to require, the subcontracting plan to be part of your proposal.
Yeah.
It's like, how are you going to do this? Right. That way we're not at the 1 yard line going, okay, I want you to win the contract. Give me this report. And then you spend 2 weeks negotiating it. So it makes more sense to make this part of the solicitation.
Yeah. Industry, you should expect that for competitions for larger than $750,000 contracts, and even in sole source negotiations, you should expect that you're going to have to submit a subcontracting plan. And government folks, you should expect that you're going to have to require one and evaluate one before you award the contract. Now, that was negotiated acquisitions. That's the FAR Part 15-y kind of stuff. 19702A1, little I, tells you that it also applies for sealed bids. If the contract resulting from the sealed bids is expected to be over $750,000 or $1.5 million for construction, same requirements apply.
Same idea that the government has to get the contracting officer has to get a subcontracting plan from you. And if they don't like it and you can't come to terms on it, then you're ineligible for award.
This can also sneak up on you. If you have a contract that is less than $750,000 or $1.5 million for construction, and you receive a contract modification that takes the total value of the contract over those thresholds, at that point, you could be required to submit a subcontracting plan.
This is a derivation of creeping requirements when the contract gets over. And this is a threshold that most people wouldn't notice, but as we talk about later, it's a big deal if you don't implement it properly.
The good news is subcontracting plans are not required for everyone. 19702B tells us that subcontracting plans are not required for small business concerns, for personal services contracts, for contracts or mods that are going to be performed entirely outside of the United States, or for modifications that are within the scope of your contract if your contract doesn't contain the clause that implements this, which is 52.219-8, called utilization of small business concerns.
That clause, however, is in pretty much everything. So the simplest way to think of this is if you're a small business, don't worry about this. If you have personal service contracts, don't worry about this. If your work is outside the United States, don't worry about this. Otherwise, worry about this.
Large businesses think about this all the time. It's a driving force. Subcontracting is a big deal. Like you said, Kevin, it gets its own section in the FAR 19.7. And the reason it's in the FAR is it's not necessarily the most efficient way to do business, and government contractors wouldn't necessarily subcontract to small businesses and especially seek out the subcategories of small businesses if the government didn't require it.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with a CEO of a large business once, and I asked that question flat out. I said, would you subcontract to small companies if not for these rules? And he was really honest and said, no, we figured out how to do it ourselves. I mean, it's a growth opportunity for us. So they wouldn't.
Yeah. We would do as much as we could ourselves, and we'd subcontract out non-core capabilities, but we wouldn't subcontract out just for the sake of subcontracting out or just for the sake of helping out the small businesses around, right? Subcontracting plans ensure that small businesses get contracts, and it helps our economy and our country by ensuring a diverse small business base.
It's also one of the ways that the U.S. government can offset what I call the inevitable effect of capitalism, which is this: if there's enough competition over time, but eventually one organization can end up running everything. So for example, Standard Oil, back in the late 1800s, owned pretty much the entire oil supply. And then, of course, the government had to do a big antitrust process to break that up. But like Microsoft owning pretty much all the operating systems for a while, and the government had to get involved. And then today, who doesn't buy stuff from Amazon? And again, that's in the open market. What I'm talking about is the government is trying to keep that from happening. One of the things that you do with these subcontracting plans is inside the government, you keep from having one company that is doing a disproportionate amount of stuff. One way to offset that and be preventative and keeping one company from running everything is say, hey, you got to award X amount to small businesses.
Yeah. We do have the giant prime contractors in the government business, but they don't do all the work themselves. They are required to flow some of that money through to small businesses, right? The government spends a lot of money and it hands the majority of that money to a few very, very large businesses. And those businesses flow that money down to hundreds and thousands of small businesses because they're required to, not necessarily because it's the most efficient way for them to do business or deliver on their requirements. Let's stop here and link this to the acquisition time zones and the execution time zones.
In both the acquisition and execution time zones, we most recently covered those in episode number 317.
Yeah, that was an overview of the zones. We also have individual episodes for each zone. On the acquisition side, this starts in the market research zone when the government has realized that it's going to award a contract over the thresholds. They know that the small business subcontracting plan is going to be required. A small business subcontracting plan is going to be required. In the RFP zone is where the offers have to write a compliant proposal that includes a subcontracting plan with these small businesses. Selection zone is where the government picks an offer and then has to verify that that plan meets their requirements before they award.
During the execution time zones, this is mostly going to show up in the performance zone, where the performance of the contract, including the subcontracting element, is going to be managed by the contractor and tracked by somebody in the government. And an example of a place where it's tracked is called the ESRS, which stands for the Electronic Subcontracting Reporting System. They're elegantly named. That's exactly what it is. But that's where contractors, again, these are large businesses, have to submit what they actually did. So during the performance zone, this is adding work for both sides.
Yeah, you can't just promise in your proposal that, oh yeah, I'm going to award to small businesses and then move on with life. You have to track it and report it. And that, like you said, that causes work. That there is quite a burden to track your subcontract awards and report them through the system. And there's a burden on the government side to make sure that they're following up on contractors that are not meeting the requirements. Since we're talking about the government, let's focus here why the government cares about small business subcontracting plans. This is not easy. It's not prescribed. There's not a checklist that says this is exactly what it should look like every time. Do it this way.
I love the fact that FAR 19705-4A says no detailed standards apply to every subcontracting plan. Like the fact that the FAR actually says no detailed standard applies is funny to me. This is the thinking part of the job. This FAR part references things like previous involvement with small business concerns should give you an indicator of what it could look like. Proven methods of involving small business concerns give you an idea what a subcontracting plan could look like. And the relative success, the methods that the contractor is intending to use. But this is all judgment calls. And so the government cares about this because the contracting officer is going to look at this and go, okay, this might be a 10-page document. It might be a 100-page document. But it depends on the complexity of the actual contract that it's going to be covering. That's the no detailed standards apply, which, again, cracks me up that that's in the FAR.
Yeah, it makes it a little more difficult because there isn't a simple checklist. One of the things that leads to is a lot of contracting officers, I know I didn't understand, but a lot of contracting officers don't have a lot of depth in how difficult it is to build and comply with a subcontracting plan, how much cost you could drive into a program by requiring a contractor to track and monitor and award to all kinds of small businesses along the way.
But because there, this, like you said, this is not a lot of folks have a lot of experience with this. So sometimes they're having to find their government folks are having to find their way. Of course, checklists are developed. So the DOD does have a checklist for reviewing subcontracting plans. So there are some checklists behind this, but they're not in the FAR. That's the point of this, is that some agencies are going to be generally answering it. Whereas if you work for some agencies in the DOD, where it's a profession almost, it could be much more serious. But again, thinking part of the job.
Yeah, I'm used to checklists for this kind of thing as well. Like you said, the DOD has a checklist. And what that leads to for industry is check the box exercises, right? You write your subcontracting plan to basically match the checklist and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And you don't necessarily think through all those things. You just make sure you have a plan that makes it easy for the contracting officer to check the boxes and say, yep, all the requirements are there. If you do that and you're awarded the contract, then you find out how much fun it is to do all those things that you just said you were going to do. And it is a big deal. If you do not comply, FAR 19.702C calls out the U.S. code where it says any contractor or subcontractor failing to comply in good faith with the requirements of the subcontracting plan is in material breach of the contract. And if you don't even make a good faith effort to comply with the requirements of the subcontracting plan, liquidated damages can be assessed upon you. Ah!
Yeah, so it's a carrot and a big stick. So the expectation is this is the plan, but if you don't stick to the plan, it's a breach of contract. And it specifically calls that out in the FAR. And that's a pretty recent change because we covered that in an episode, I don't know, like 100 episodes ago. But that language about breach of contract is relatively new.
Yeah. It tells you that contractors were not complying, so they had to bring out the stick. The carrot wasn't enough. They had to bring out the stick. And one of the reasons why contractors don't want to comply is because it costs money. It's more work. You wouldn't necessarily seek out small business subcontractors or subcategories of small business subcontractors. And you certainly wouldn't track all that data and report it if the government didn't require you to, right? If you're a contractor trying to get a job done, you want to do it in the most efficient and inexpensive way possible that meets all the requirements that you need to meet. You don't want to do a bunch of things that feel non-productive. So you really have to get it in your head that this subcontracting stuff is part of the job, and you have to build those costs into your proposal and into your execution plan from the beginning. You have to do them.
And the government might not realize, in fact, I didn't realize when I was a contracting officer, the staff that industry has to have just for this function. The people like the small business liaison officer at a company, this is why they exist. One of the reasons they exist is to go find these smaller companies to subcontract to. And think about what you're doing. As a large business who's made a plan, you have this piece that has to get done. If it gets screwed up, the government's going to blame you, not that small company, right? So you're putting your reputation in the hands of this small company, this hub zone company that you have to award to. So it's not just a matter of, hey, go find a hub zone. It's like, well, find the right one. Well, that takes time and work and due diligence and, you know, all the stuff I was clueless of when I was a contracting officer.
And then after you find them, you have to manage them, right? They may need more management than a larger business that's more mature, right? Big companies, the big government contractors, have subcontracting and procurement departments to manage this type of thing. Where it's particularly challenging is when you're one of those medium-sized businesses where you were a small business and you've just tripped over the thresholds to become a large business. Now, all of these requirements apply to you and you have to learn how to do this quickly, almost overnight if you haven't planned for it. So I guess the message there is plan for it. It's going to happen.
And that's the place that you landed after you left being a contracting officer. You landed in a small large.
Right.
So you got to live all that stuff.
Small company that's trying to scale to a large business very, very quickly.
Yeah. Being a small large is a whole different experience.
Speaking of a whole different experience, let's try to finish this episode in less than 30 minutes. Make this one a quick one.
Jinx it. The point of this all is that know when this applies and when it doesn't. Know when the subcontracting plan is going to sneak up on you, when it's going to be implemented, and when it could be a breach of contract if you don't actually do what you said you would do.
Yeah. Expect that it's going to increase cost and complexity for your contracts. Whether you're on government or industry side, it's going to cost you more if you're the government folks. It's going to cost you more to execute if you're the industry folks. And on both sides, you're going to have more work to do.
We'll cover what goes into a subcontracting plan in a future episode. But for those of you who want to read ahead, it's in FAR 19704, which is one of the subsections we've been covering. But we don't want to leave you hanging, so I wanted to give you the FAR reference.
Yeah, remember, small businesses, the requirement for the plan doesn't apply to you, but you get the benefit of it, right? Your large business partners have to meet these goals because their agencies have required them to. When you're targeting large businesses and you're a small business, make sure they know that you're a small business or a specific subcategory. Talk to that large business's small business liaison or talk to the head of their procurement department. Let them know that you can help them meet their goals. They may award to you just to meet the goals and give you an opportunity that you may not have had otherwise.
And just to foot stomp, you also need to target what are they looking for and do the work, then bring up the fact that you're a hub zone or women owned or whatever.
Yeah, we
but
say
to your
that.
Point is that they need somebody to do this work who is a women owned small business. Well, if you come to and say, this is the work we do, we're also a women owned small business versus, you know, swinging the small business status around looking for somebody to hire you. Okay. In theory, that worked. But again, the large business, the prime contractor, is putting their reputation on the line by giving the contract to you. Yeah. So they want to know the women-owned small business or veteran-owned may get you in the door. But again, you got to do the work. You got to be capable. So it's both.
I'm not going to award to a company that just happens to meet one of the small business requirements if they have no idea what they're doing. Right. First, I got to know what they're doing, that they can do the job. Then I might ignore the ones that aren't small businesses and just award to this one out of all the companies that can do it.
Yeah, that's a better way. Yeah, it's a more eloquent way of saying it.
If you're a big business, remember this is a requirement and it's a breach of contract if you don't do it, if you don't follow your plan and you have to report on it. Remember that your contract value can creep above that threshold and suddenly you're going to have to do this even mid-contract. That's not the most common case. The most common case is you write a plan and submit it with your proposal. It's awarded. Then you have to actually do what that plan says and report on it, or you're in trouble. That's the stick, right?
Well, and the creeping requirement, that it must have happened because that's how it ended up in the FAR.
Yeah.
It happened to somebody.
Exactly. All right, Kevin, I'll talk to you later.
All right, I'll see you, Paul.
All right, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. When you're knee-deep in subcontracting plans, remember that Skyway's team of former contracting officers is here to help through custom consulting and training. Go to skywayacq.com or give us a call at 877-884-5280. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.